Hello and welcome. I'm Laura Briggs with the Vegan Fitness Runner podcast, where I'll be talking all things running, health and fitness, and what it means to be an active vegan. Legendary vegan Fiona Oakes is my next guest. She's an elite marathon runner, and she's won the North Pole Marathon and the Antarctic Ice Marathon, and holds 4 Guinness World Records in endurance running. She eats just one meal a day, and has been vegan since the age of 6. Her reason for running? It's for the animals. She runs Tower Hill Stables Animal Sanctuary, where she looks after more than 500 animals, together with her trusty sidekick, Percy. Hello, Fiona.
Hello, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. All the better for speaking to you today.
Thank you.
You loving these bright, sunny days, aren't you, Fiona, I imagine?
I am absolutely adoring them. I tell you, you spend all the winter just hoping for these few months when you can just like max out in the better weather and, you know, run and cycle and swim and look after the animals, and it's not raining. And well, it has been raining, I must admit, but it's warmer and it always dries up and there isn't the mud everywhere. So I'm really, really in my element at the moment.
And I read or heard you saying somewhere, Fiona, that you get up about 3:30 a.m. Is that still the case?
It's still the case, yes, I do. It's just something that I've done for decades now. I think it's a blessing to be able to greet. It's like a veil being lifted on the night and then seeing the magic of the world around you appear. And the same in the evening time, if you see what I mean, at dusk, it's like, you know, the world transcends into darkness again. And I always feel very blessed in the morning that I can get up and experience another cycle, another 24 hours again. And I don't always, you know, sort of jump out of bed and think, you know, oh, great, it's 3:30, I can get up. But what I try to do is if I'm not feeling very kind of motivated, I'll kind of literally think of 5 good reasons why I am so lucky to be able to do this before I get up. And it always works, but you kind of guilt trip yourself and you think, how blessed are you to have a body that will allow you to just take on what I'm going to take on in the day, you know, whether it be like a 20-mile run or you know, just looking after the animals. Physically, just so lucky when so many people aren't. So yeah, it always works, and I enjoy a long day, getting the most out of life, because it is very short, and the older you get, you realise that. So I just want to pack as much in, and so it just works to be able to get up very, very early. The animals like it. It suits their regime. It suits me. So if it's good, you know, keep doing it.
I really admire your work ethic, and I love the way that you can motivate yourself to get up at 3:30. I definitely try and get up early. I very much would love to be kind of maybe a 5:30 girl. But yeah, I find it tough. So having those little motivational lines maybe might help me. And it seems that you really are driven to get up early and to seize the day because of the animals, a lot of it. Is that right?
It's definitely because of the animals. I mean, I originally started the routine when I actually worked in London, and I worked in merchant banking. This is decades ago. And it was the only little bit of free time that I knew I would definitely have was before I actually went to work. So if I wanted to do any training or whatever I wanted to do, I had to do it then, because it was one of those jobs where, you know, documents were always coming in late. You tended to have to work very late. It was a bit of a profession where it was bums on seats. You know, you were expected to work long hours. So that bit of free time that I had was always very early in the morning. So I utilised it. I used to go out cycling, do a long bike ride, then cycling to work. And then I knew that whatever else happened in the day, I'd done my training. And it kind of, you know, when I got the sanctuary back in, you know, kind of the 90s, it continued on. And I'd become used to it. It was just part of my regime. My body had adapted to it. And it works very, very well, especially with the you know, the volume of work that I have to get through every day. It's just maximising the hours in the day. But funnily enough, people do ask me, well, how do you keep going all day? You know, and I say, you know, I don't do the same thing all the time during the day. So, for instance, I don't rest. good in terms of sit down and have a break. But if I've been doing something kind of very physical, like running, I might then, instead of, you know, just chilling out, doing nothing, I'll do some computer work, which is mentally demanding, but not physically demanding. And then I'll go to something that's more physical, such as looking after the animals, but it's not as physically cardiovascular demanding as running. And that's the kind of way I compartmentalize it all. So I keep going, but it's with different disciplines working, if you like, same within sport, different muscle groups, but the muscle groups including the mind as well. So it's a jumbled up day. And when people have been here, when Keegan came to make the film Running for Good, I actually asked him, do you want to stay at Sanctuary with me? And he said, no, I don't want to. A, I don't want to upset your routine, and B, I don't want to get up at 3:30.
Which seems very reasonable, actually.
Yeah.
It must, though, Fiona, getting up at 3:30 and being busy, whether it be using your mind or your body, looking after the animals, having those extra hours in the day surely got to benefit you in terms of the running that you do and the competitions that you take part in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I mean, everything is relative. And when people write to me and say, oh, I don't run as fast as you, I'm never going to run sub 2:40 in a marathon, I'm never going to be able to do that. It's all relative on what you want to achieve. So now, for instance, today, when I've done this call, I'll probably go out and run 20 miles with my pack because I'm training for a race that's self-sufficient. It's just what you're used to. That doesn't seem like a great challenge to me. I'm quite looking forward to it. It's under 3 hours of running, and it's something that I can fit in very easy. As I said, because we've got daylight hours up to 9 o'clock, it's a lot easier. But yeah, I mean, I like to be the best version of myself that I can possibly be, whether it be running, whether it be looking after the animals, whether it be doing, you know, computer work, writing stuff. It's just about getting the most out of myself. I enjoy that. I enjoy challenging myself. I mean, obviously, a lot of the races that I run, especially the longer distance stuff, it is about mental discipline. Physically, you've got to be relatively fit, but the mental stuff really comes in. You've got to be able to push yourself, know how to keep going, know how, if you're feeling you're going into a dark place, know how to get through it. And you know, the challenges of every day for me, pretty much like that. So it's not too much different when I find myself in a desert or at the North Pole. like, hang on a minute, this is what I do. Just get on with it, Fiona.
Have you always had that mindset, or is that something that you think you've worked on over the years? Does it come naturally, or have you just had to build that up?
I think it probably comes naturally, and I think tracing into my ancestry, I'm not going to go into some long convoluted thing. I mean, my granddad was very much like me. I mean, I can see a lot of myself in my granddad. He was very much like that. So it's probably something I've inherited from him. In my formative years, probably I can't really... I've actually always been very, very focused. If I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it, and nothing is going to dissuade me. It's been gut instinct, you know, just a gut instinct in me, rather than some kind of learned or considered thought process. I did adopt a vegan diet when I was very, very young, 6 years old. And people say, oh, did you come from some flamboyantly bohemian background, you know, where veganism was just part and parcel and extra? No, I didn't. I actually came from a very kind of mainstream and kind of mundane background. You know, mum was a pianist, then she became a nurse. Dad was in the mining industry. And I didn't say to my mum, I want to become vegan. I didn't know what the word vegan was at 6 years old. I just adopted, it was the principle. I didn't want to harm animals. I'd been vegetarian since I was three. And I just knew that I didn't want to hurt my sister or my parents or my grandparents. So I just see animals as my extended family. And it was just something very kind of fundamentally obvious to me to not eat them. If you love them, why would you eat them? I wouldn't eat my sister if I was hungry, so I wouldn't eat a cow or a camel or anything, you know. It just seems so obvious. So but it's all been through kind of just gut instinct. It's never been anything contrived. There isn't anything contrived in my life. And people, I didn't set out, you know, thinking at 6 years old, you know, I must become vegan, and then, you know, I must have an animal sanctuary. I mean, obviously that was always the big dream. And then I must become a firefighter, and then I must set some world records in marathon running. It's kind of organically grown. It's just and I, during the lockdowns, when a lot of people have turned to kind of the internet and social media, and a lot, I think there's been a lot of confrontation on that. I've gone more into contemplation. I've used my running to go out just for hours and hours and hours, and probably look back and kind of take a bit of a rain check and think, why did I do all this? What was going on in my mind? Because I've never really stopped to think. If it feels right, I'll grab it and literally, so not to make too much of a pun, run with it. And that's what my life's been about.
I find it really interesting that you went vegan at the age of six, certainly on a personal level, and a lot of other vegans who maybe became vegan later in life have said to me, and I would certainly kind of mirror their views on this, that having parents who aren't vegan kind of, for me, made me maybe not question what I was doing. And you had that, you know, that strong will and that awareness at such a young age that actually this isn't right. Whereas a lot of children are kind of, you know, it's, I suppose, an indoctrination, isn't it? You just do it because your parents did it. So to actually kind of buck the trend and say, no, this is not for me, that takes a lot of, strength, actually.
It does. And I'm not going to deny that part attributed to that is my mum. Because obviously my mum is, well, she's the person I've always been closest to. I mean, my mum gave birth to me. She understands me. And my mum always said that for some reason she knew I was different. I've got an older sister, Alison, and she's much more kind of, she's quite academic. I mean, I was never what would consider amazingly bright at school. Alison always was. And I remember when I went to school, went to the same school as Alison, but she was in a year ahead of me. She's older than me. One of the teachers commented to my mum. She said, Fiona, yes, well, let's put it like this. You haven't got another Alice. Oh. And my mum said, thank goodness for that. And but I kind of have always been very headstrong. I was always different. I mean, my auntie Nancy always recognised that. She was my great aunt. She'd always lived on the land. She knew I was different. But my mum, I wouldn't say understood it particularly, but she understood it was something that was part of me. Dad, not so. He was dead against it. Grandparents, absolutely against it. Mum was very, very lucky. I said my mum was a pianist. She wasn't a flamboyantly good, she was a piano teacher. She was relatively good, but not good enough to become a full-time, you know, kind of, you know, concert pianist or anything like that. But she went to a grammar school in the 1950s, and one of her teachers at the school, a music teacher, was a vegan lady, and she knew actually Donald Watson, and she remained in touch with this lady, and she was able to articulate to my mum in adult terms what veganism was about, what I was likely to be feeling, how to help me, how to encourage me. So we were very, very, very lucky to have that role model, and also a supportive mother who didn't insist that I was wrong. And believe you me, I think every parent that she ever came across said, bar one older lady said, if it was my daughter, I'd make her. I'd make her eat meat. And the time that we really got problems with this was when I started to go into hospital for my operations, my orthopedic operations. And at that point in time, veganism was aligned to an eating disorder, such as anorexia or bulimia. And my mum was accused of child abuse. And that was very difficult, because I have said that at that point, my mum was only a student nurse. And so, you know, it was very, very difficult as a student nurse to have a daughter that was going into hospital on a vegan diet, and then the people who were actually superior to my mum, more senior to my mum, saying she was abusing her own daughter.
That must have been very difficult for your mum.
very, very difficult. But she always stood by and said, you know, the real abuse and cruelty would be to lie to her and to look back and find that she despised me because of it, because I'd done wrong, because I hadn't allowed her to be who she is. And so, you know, I am very lucky to have had. So I do totally understand. I don't know how it would have been without my mum's support. And indeed, to this very day, my mum is still, but she lives with me. Mum and dad live with me. Dad's very, very poorly now. We nurse him 24 hours. He's totally bedridden. But my mum still does all the cooking. Mum's like a mini me. She's very, 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 very independent, very strong. And, you know, we stick together. And it was very natural to her. She knew that there was something about me and animals from a very, very, very young age. And I suppose it's the kind of things that parents notice. Mum probably noticed that, you know, Fiona isn't playing with conventional toys. She's like making a little stable for a cow all the time. Or she wants, you know, rather than buy, you know, my sister was like into, I don't know, Girls World or dollies or whatever. Fiona was always wanting a piece of green baize where she could put little horse figures on it, you know. So, you know, as parents, you know, obviously they pick up on things like that. I have to, you know, it resonates with me when people say, you know, that their parents don't support them. And you tend to want to please your parents and do as they ask. You don't want to upset anyone. So you tend to go with what they tell you. But likewise, when people do say that, you know, the only regret they have with veganism is that they didn't go vegan earlier, that kind of also resonates with me, because I feel very, very blessed that mum kind of, I say, allowed me to do so.
I mean, also, you know, as transitioning to a vegan much later on in life, you come up against all sorts of prejudices, as you will have known, because you've been doing it for so long. But as a child, to face that, you know, must have been even tougher for you to kind of stand your ground and say, actually, this is what I'm doing.
I didn't have many friends at school. I was taken out of school at probably 13 because of my operations. Literally, I was in and out of hospital all the time. I was pretty much homeschooled, but I wasn't schooled. I was actually literally, Alison, my sister, did help me because she was a clever girl. So she helped me with things like Latin and stuff like that. And I just had those revised GCSE at home books and I had to get on with it. I had to get, it was a very, very troubled time as well, actually, because my father was, you know, he was on strike a lot of the time. So money was very, very short in the family. We were completely dependent on my mum's wage as a student nurse and then as a nurse. Very, very difficult times. But actually, you know, looking at what some people have to face and the challenges, it was nothing. You know, I mean, obviously, but to put it into context, you know, people were, my peer group, my parents' peer group, you know, they were losing their homes. We were asked if we could afford food and if we needed to go to a soup kitchen for food, stuff like that. So it was quite challenging. It is what it is. And I always think that we're very, very blessed in this country. Sometimes we overlook blessings we have and we fixate on the things that we don't have rather than appreciating the things that we do have. It was difficult as a child, but I didn't attend school a lot. I didn't get on with school very well. You know, I wanted to be outside all the time. I wanted to be doing things with my hands. I wanted to be doing things with animals. I just wanted to be in nature all the time. So, I was a little bit of a loner as a child, but you know, hey ho, you know, that's just part of the fabric that makes up me. And I don't resent the fact that, you know, I was hospitalized for a lot of my teenage years. It's you accept it and understand that it's part of what has made you who you are. And the main thing is to be the best version you can of yourself. And that's what I try to be. And so all these little kind of events that have happened have led to making the person that I am right now. And I try to be, you know, I hope that is giving the best positive impact on this planet and those who inhabit it for as long as I can.
That's a brilliant philosophy, and it certainly, you know, comes across that it's made you a much stronger person. With the hospitalization that you've touched on, that was for your knee, is that correct? So can you tell us a little bit about your knee and how that impacts on your running now?
Yeah, I mean, I was. It was a long time ago. Firstly, I mean, it was before people forget, before the internet, before social media, before Google search, what's wrong with my knee, before chat groups, before any of that. So you're very much relying on mainstream, medicine, and it was started off as basically just a condition that, like an orthopedic condition, that very, very sporty kids tended to get. And it got worse and worse and worse. I had multiple operations, surgeries on both legs. And in the end, we just went to the consultant and said, look, the kneecap is just completely crumbled. It's got to come out. This is going to be really, really difficult. It's a very, very painful operation, major operation. And you probably will never walk properly again, let alone be able to do some of the activities that you've done, such as running. So it was pretty devastating at the time, but I think it was so painful and it was causing so much problems to me. I was on crutches all the time that I kind of thought, I just want to get it done and get on with life. I just want to be able to kind of move forward from this. I don't want to be going to the hospital every 6 weeks and having it looked at and, you know, non-weight bearing in plaster again, go home and come back in 6-8 weeks and we'll have another look inside. I didn't want that anymore. So it went on and on and on for about 4 years. And after that, the first thing on my mind wasn't running. I mean, to be honest with you, people laugh and say, I don't consider myself to this day to be a runner. I'm just somebody advocating for animals through athletics. I only stumbled upon running after the operations, after the surgeries, when I moved to Oxford to do a training course and then to London to work. I was into cycling because it was no impact. It was literally a fairly safe sport to do. If you've got this kind of knee injury, both legs are quite weak, but the right one is very weak and dislocates very, very easily. So I couldn't have been further away from running at that point. In 1996, when I managed to kind of fulfill what I thought what would be a dream forever, but never a reality, and sort of managed to scramble together the funds to get the sanctuary. And I didn't set the sanctuary up, I always say, as a sanctuary in terms of it was actually a place for the animals that I'd already rescued. Tower Hill Stables came about because I was literally working in London and rescuing horses and dogs and cats and chickens and keeping them at the little property that I got. Not the horses, they were a farm that I rented a field from. And then one of the horses, an ex-racer, was called Oscar, that I'd been rehabilitating. He had an accident in the field, and I used to cycle to work, do the horses, cycle home, do them on the way home. And I came home one night, and seven of the horses were in the field. Six came to me and Oscar didn't. And I found that he'd become impaled on a fence, and he nearly lost his life. He was at the vet for 13 weeks. And it transpired, somebody told me that the person who owned the property had allowed people to go and shoot rabbits in the field where my horses were. Oscar was a racehorse, ex-racehorse. He was quite highly strung. He'd become very, very nervous and bolted into a fence, and his hind leg it was nearly hanging off. And he went to the vet, and at that point my whole family said, look, we can't go on with this. We've either got to stop keeping, you know, equines, or you've got to have somewhere that you can have them on your own terms. And at that point everybody just rallied around, my great aunts, my grandparents, everybody put in what they got and managed to scramble together the deposit for Tower Hill Stables. And I took all the animals that I'd rescued to that point to there, and it was their sanctuary. That's when I started to rescue a few more animals, but it wasn't, I realised that, you know what, I could rescue, you know, 40, 400, 4,000, but there's billions out there suffering and I can't help them. Sanctuaries are great. They are the answer for the animals that you can literally take out of abhorrent situations where they've been cruelly treated or exploited and give them one-to-one care. So for them individually, it is the answer. But moving forward on a larger scale, the answer is to stop the need for sanctuaries, stop animals being exploited so you don't need to rescue them, in effect. And so after a while, I thought, well, what can I do? What can I do to address this situation? I mean, the bad press, I mean, there was literally hardly any press about veganism. I mean, I don't know if you can remember that this explosion of the word vegan has come about in the last literally few years. You know, 20, 25 years ago, nobody had hardly heard what a vegetarian was, let alone a vegan. And all I knew is that I was fit, strong, healthy. I mean, I was in, by this point, I joined the fire brigade. It's a retained service. So it was actually something that, funnily enough, somebody had seen me out and he called me over and said, you know, you look really, really fit. Why don't, have you ever thought about joining the fire brigade? And I thought, that's a bit bizarre question to stop somebody after. And he said, look, we've got a retained fire brigade locally. We're looking for recruits. One of the main criteria that people struggle with is the fitness level to get in the brigade. Come down and see what you think. I went down to the fire station that Monday evening, and it's a very, very male orientated world. It was the only female firefighter in the whole division on the retained side. And I felt a little bit, you know, kind of, I don't know, out of place down there. But I enjoy that kind of activity, you know, that kind of sort of more physical activity. So in the end, I decided to join the fire service because it gave me an opportunity to raise awareness and bring awareness to a group of people and an organisation that had probably not given too much thought about veganism in the past. Indeed, when I went down for the first physical recruitment assessment, I remember that halfway through the morning they brought out a tray of drinks and there were tea and coffee. Unfortunately, there was milk in all the tea and coffee, and I declined and asked if I could have a glass of water, and there was a little bit of questioning went on, and the guy, the sub-officer taking the session, said, what is wrong with you? And I said, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm just vegan. And the kind of whole been quiet, and he just came and pressed his face into mine and said, oh, one of those. He said the last one of those we had down here lasted 3 hours, but that was a man, so I don't give you long. And that kind of, you know, so I'll
lit
show
the
you
fire
I,
in
you know,
your belly.
Literally, yeah. And anyway, it just gave me an opportunity in a very, very kind of softly way to show, you know, it's a very, very kind of considered physical profession that, you know, as a vegan and as a woman, I could do it just as well as the men. But after that, I thought, you know, okay, what else can I do? And I thought, I am physically strong. And it kind of annoyed me that when veganism actually got any press, it was always negative press. And I wanted to make it positive and say, you know, actually, I've been plant-based for decades now, even at that point. And look, I'm not keeling over. I'm physically strong. I'm physically fit. And the reason I turned to running was that literally female sport, you know, actually doesn't get the attention that the men's sport tends to get anyway. But at that time, the buzzword was the marathon because of Paula Radcliffe. You know, she was running really, really well in the marathon, world records, and, you know, and so it got kind of all the, if you like, euphemistic hashtags attached to it. It's brutal. You've got to be physically and mentally strong and disciplined and endurance and extreme. You got all those. And I thought, you know, if I could just compete in and hopefully complete a marathon, even if it's really, really slow or whatever, I mean, it's a big challenge, then it shows that, you know, being, you know, plant-based, living on plants your entire practical life is not going to be prohibitive to doing anything. If I can do the most kind of arduous and extreme event in the athletics calendar, as it was considered at that point, you know, I'm sure you can, you know, get off the sofa and make a cup of tea or whatever you want to do as a vegan. And it was always this idea that, you know, vegans look as if they've been dug up from somewhere, or, you know, like you're literally going to be, you know, you're going to struggle to survive, let alone thrive. And so, you know, I thought, well, I wonder if I could just like jog for 26 miles. And that is literally how I started. Just jogging and then jogging a bit further and jogging a bit further and then trying to jog a bit further, a bit faster. You know, so I do get it when people ask for advice, you know, couch to, you know, to 5K. I understand all that because that's exactly how I started. And it was all trial and error, a lot of trials and a lot of errors. After I, you know, decided that I'd try one or two little local shorter distance races, you know, 10Ks, and started to win those, somebody did say, you know, you know, trying to train for a marathon, you want to get yourself a coach. And I thought, well, that's a good idea. Somebody who can advise in what you have to do to not just obviously get through the distance, but how do you get the maximum out of yourself in the distance? How do you improve your pace? What do you have to do? And as I said, this is before you could like Google search runners world sub 3 hour marathon training plan. You know, it wasn't there to, you know, the information wasn't online. And I did approach one or two people. Indeed, one or two coaches did approach me at clubs and that I used to attend, you know, just local running club. But they said, look, it's a waste of time because on a plant-based diet, you're not going to get the nutrients you need and you're not going to have the physical strength to take the punishment that your body will have to take and recover and repair from to get where you want to go, which was like, you know, I originally just wanted to compete a marathon, but after I'd competed and completed a marathon, I then started to look and think, you know, well, what do you have to do to get on the championship start of London? After that, what do you have to do to sub three? And then I really set my goals high. And what do you have to do to stand next to Haile Gebrselassie on the front grid of the Berlin Marathon? And but obviously, the, you know, my diet, it was never up for compromise. So I've had to do it all on my own. I've had to self-coach. I've never had any physio. I've never had anything, actually. I've really never had any of the kind of gadgets and advice. And I don't, you know, even today, train with any kind of technology. I've got the older Timex Iron Man watch on, you know, that, you know, I mean, literally, it's all in my head, you know, pace, everything. I've just learned to become very self-reliant to get, you know, to get where I am. I mean, I'm not a great runner. I mean, I'm not, you know, really quick. I'm not really strong. I've got the most horrible running style you could possibly ever imagine. In fact, when Keegan made the film, he approached me in about 2016 and said he wanted to make this film about me. And I thought it was absolutely ludicrous, ridiculous, and just a joke to start with. And it kind of went on, and Keegan came to film, and, you know, and then he kept sending me kind of clips of the film. He was really excited about it. But I'm quite shy, if you like. I don't want to look at myself on the small screen. I don't want to look at myself particularly. I'm not that kind of person. So I kept saying, yeah, I'm sure it's all fantastic, Keegan. You're in charge. I'll just go with what you want. And when he actually invited me out to Hollywood with Rich Roll, you know, with cinema full of people to see this film, Rich Roll came over to me and said, because he narrated it, you must be really, really, you know, thrilled and, you know, and excited. I said, what do you mean? And, you know, about the film, and it looks great, you know, doesn't it? And I said, don't know, I haven't watched it yet. And he just looked at me and said, you've come out, you haven't even watched the film. I said, no. Why would I want to watch myself on a small screen? I'm dreading watching myself on a big screen. I mean, it was like the worst thing I could possibly imagine. And I kind of calmed myself down because he dragged me to the front of the auditorium and sat me next to him and said, look, you're gonna sit with me and you're gonna watch this film. And it was like, oh, peeking through, like Percy covering my eyes up. And it was like really, really difficult. And I thought, look, calm down. You can't look that bad. You've got all the gear on. Keegan's a great director, you know, a great cinematographer. You're in this spectacular setting. And then I just looked and thought, oh, no, you look awful. You're just limping along. I know I limp. I know I haven't got great style. But I have got a lot of physical, I'm strong, but more than that, I'm mentally very strong. So I literally have worked extremely, really hard over many, many years through discipline and kind of determination and dedication to be the best version of somebody running, I won't say a runner, somebody who is running, that I can possibly be.
I think a lot of your appeal to other runners, Fiona, must be the fact that you are really unassuming and that you are very down to earth. And it's very refreshing as a runner to hear from somebody who is so successful to say, do you know what? I don't have a coach. I don't have physio. I don't use a watch. We have a tendency, don't we, a lot of us, to really add problems to something that maybe wasn't there in the first place, to overcomplicate running. Do you think that's the case?
I think so. I like to run because it is very pure. It's a very pure form of exercise. You put on whatever you're going to run in and you go out and you run. And I think you are absolutely correct. Overcomplicating it, setting ridiculous goals, stressing out over things inhibits your running. The gadgetry, I mean, obviously when I started, it was like, have you got a pulse monitor? And, you know, I mean, that was the big thing, the pulse monitor. No, I can quite clearly hear my heart banging in my ear. You know, panting. I think, you know, we have the most, at the moment we do, which is a so-called sophisticated computer built in about a person in terms of your brain. So my mantra has been to learn to use that in terms of, okay, you can have some sort of thing on your wrist that's bleeping away, but it doesn't know if you've had a good day. It doesn't know if you're upset because, you know, say dad's been very, very poorly or one of the horses is down. It doesn't know those things. You do. So compensate that in and calibrate that into your running. You know if you're running well, you know if you've got a problem. And I think just to downloading spreadsheets and all that thing, I'm not saying it doesn't work for some people. It might be great for some people and it might be that motivates them to get out there, in which case go for it. But for me, no, it's all about being able to be out there without the gadgetry. When I'm out, I don't tend to listen to music or anything like that. I like to, you know, hear my literally own heartbeat, that feet on the ground. You know, I like to look around, I like to listen to nature, I like to listen to the waves lapping. And I do actually, on a more serious note, I like to be quite spatially aware when I'm out running, because, you know, anything can be going on around you. And I think sometimes you've got to be very, very aware. But yeah, I think keep it simple. Keep it simple with the running. Keep life simple. We do overcomplicate things and we stress about things which we've got no control over. It's like, funny story is when you get out to races such as the Marathon de Sable, and you've spent all this time preparing for it, packing for it, training for it, worrying about it, worrying about going, worrying about not being able to go. And you arrive out there and you have all your bag checked and your body's checked, everything's checked. And then you toddle off back to your tent with your road book. And that road book is quite a big thing. And you start to look at the road book. And you can hear literally people cries of kind of like, oh my, no, look what day four, you know, look at the long stage. Oh, there's a big climb in the long stage. And oh, look at day five and look at day two and look at the distance. And people said to me, are you going to read your road book? And I said, not really, no. Why not? I said, well, can't do anything about it right now. I can't suddenly think, oh, there's a big Jebel on Wednesday. I better go and do a bit of Jebel climbing to train. All I can do is actually make it worse. It might not be as bad as you think it's going to be. You can wind yourself up over stuff that you've got no control over and just, you know, waste energy doing so. I am just going to sit and take it as it comes. I don't think I'm going to be like out of the front of the race with the Moroccans in this race. So I'm just going to literally one foot in front of the other and meet each challenge as best I can when I come to it. And that's pretty much the way I head with my life. You know, at the end of the day, you can only do what you can do. Obviously, you've got to plan to a certain extent. But, you know, just, you know, whatever way you can get through things, get over them, round them, under them, but just get through it. And that's pretty much the same with running, with whatever I'm doing. I'm very, very good also at just doing mundane tasks for a long time, just focusing. And I find it actually quite relaxing to just, if I've got something to do, like a long run, or I've got loads and like 4 hours of shoveling muck, I'm just very good at going out and doing it, you know, just accepting that it's got to be done, and sitting around and wasting time stressing over it is not productive. Just go and do it. And it's, you know what, it's never really as bad as, you know, very, I mean, I you know, I dread some runs, you know, I do say, oh no, I've got to go running, oh no, you know, what, you know, so anything can distract you from the potential prospect of going out, you know, something you might see on television or, I dare say, social media. But it's rarely, very rarely, as bad as you think it's going to be. So it's just about getting the clothes on and getting out there and doing it.
And you take pleasure in the simple things, which is lovely. And I think everybody can kind of maybe take a leaf out of your book and, you know, remember that we have more than we think we have, and we are luckier than we think we are, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, when people do ask me, the intricacies of my diet. And it's like, I don't know. I eat what's there. Mum cooks it. If, you know, I eat seasonally, what's available. I'm going to say what's cheap, because I haven't got a lot of money. But obviously, I've not got huge coffers. You know, I'm not a professional sports person. This is what I always say. I've got my little Patreon page. Proceeds go to the sanctuary. And it's just like, this is a day in the life of Fiona. And I, some of the runs, I mean, I'm posting pictures when I've done my running. And it's just like, oh, what has she been doing? Has she been out in a force 10 gale and beaten up by a gorilla? I mean, what is going on there? But that's how I actually look when I finish running. And I don't fabricate, I don't filter anything. It's as it is, as it happens, raw, pure core. That's me. And so with the food, you know, protein. But where do you get your protein? Where do you get your amino acids? Where do you get that? I don't really know. I mean, I've roughly got an idea because, you know, obviously we all know that, you know, beans and, you know, stuff like that. But it's very basic. And I'm blessed for that. I don't have any of the replacement products. You know, I've never seen a need for anything like just like meat or, you know, sausagely or anything. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying for me personally, I've never had those products. I've never actually had them in the first place. So I don't need to replace something that I've never had. But I look at other aspects of food that people sometimes overlook. And I think certainly with the unrest there is in the world today, we are guilty of doing this. So for instance, I eat food. I'm not worried where the next meal's coming from. I eat food that's prepared with love and eaten with the same love and respect, i.e. from my mum. I've still got my parents, so that, you know, even as I say, I'm very, very blessed. I don't live in a war-torn area. I haven't been displaced from my home. I'm not worried about famine. I'm not worried about water poverty. Well, I am. I'm worried about it for other people and certainly worried about how it's going to impact on a day-to-day basis. These aren't fears, very, very real living fears of having the tap to turn on and nothing comes out. I think that's what I like about the self-sufficiency races, the week-long, where literally you have to carry everything you're going to need, food, supplies, medicals, everything on your back for the whole week, because it's a real, real acute reminder of how precious every little resource is. You know, if you find two extra sheets of toilet paper, you think you're on a real winner, you know, in those races, you know. And I think that these are things that we very, very often take for granted. It's very easy to do so when we have so many luxuries around us, you know, and I'm talking like flushing toilets, you know, and taps and hot water and a washing machine and, you know, those what we would consider very basic things that a vast, vast amount of the world's population have never seen, have never had. So I tend to literally focus on those very, very basic things, if you like, knowing how lucky I am to have them. And only a short plane ride away, people don't have them. And so it seems very trite to kind of moan about stuff that actually doesn't really matter. You know, what matters is the basic things in life, the things that we take for granted that actually, I mean, it's like when you're trudging across your desert with your backpack and you're thinking, why on earth did I, why did I enter this raid? What was I thinking? And, you know, if somebody stops and asks you, you know, would you like a big bag of money or a bottle of water, you go for the water because that's actually got real value, and money and you know, the things that it could buy that you perceive as a life and death and you can't live without have no real meaning when everything is actually stripped back to basics. It's the same with the animals. You know, we are no different to the animals. We crave the same things, you know, security, food, water, shelter, company, no fear, no pain. You know, those are the very, very basic things. And that's for humans and non-human animals alike.
I once heard you in an interview, Fiona, and I think somebody was asking a similar nutrition question, like, oh, you know, when you're training for an ultra marathon, say, you know, 50k, whatever, you know, what's your nutrition plan? What food do you carry with you? And I think you'd said something like, oh, not much. You know, it was literally like, I don't.
And this is where the problem I've always incurred. I have really had some problems, you know, because you're encouraged to lie, basically, to tell people what is the conventional norm to tell them when it's not actually the truth. And then you kind of told off, you shouldn't say that. But if it's the truth, why can't I say it? So I do eat one meal a day. So one meal a day used to be, you eat one meal a day. And then, I've got a funny story though. When I was in, I did a part of my world records, the marathon that I did for the Asian leg, I did an OMS, and I was there with the Kenyan and Ethiopian coaches and athletes, and they laid on a big kind of dinner for us, lunch the day before the race. And one of the Kenyan coaches said to me, are you coming for the lunch? And I said, no, I don't eat lunch. And he said, oh, why is that? I said, I only have one meal a day. I dare tell him. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, tell me more. And I said, well, I just find it works with my training regime. Obviously, I've always been very, very basic in my running. So it's not just concentrating on what goes in. It's what comes out and when, because you've got to that's a big point of a marathon. If you need the toilet during a marathon, you're going to lose time. It's all about not losing time and managing yourself so you know your body well enough to not do that. And so he said, yes, a lot of the Kenyans do that. I said, do they? He said, yes, it's the warrior diet. And I kind of looked at him and I said, yes, I'm on the warrior diet. You know, no, it was warrior diet. It's just like convenient for me, and it just works for me. And, or now it's been intermittent fasting, so it's all kind of cool. So I'm right, a world leader in intermittent fasting. Just not. It's just what worked for me. You know. So I truly, if I'm just running 20 odd miles today, I wouldn't dream of taking anything out with me to eat. I wouldn't even consider that I'd need food. And to be honest with you, I shouldn't say it, but I do carry water. I do carry it because it's ballast. I need to train with it. Very rarely stop for a drink. Very, very rarely. I'm very, very good at just plodding on. If you're going to be, I have been very, very, it's a really, really weird life that I've led with my running, because I am literally the world's most amateur runner. I do not think about running until I've got to run. And when I make my little videos for my Patreon, I have to do them when I've just got back from my running, because it just goes out of my head. As soon as I've changed into my wellies, running's out the window. But I have literally been the person that's bolting around the house, screaming at my mom, socks, you know, and like, oh, they're in the washing machine, and you're dragging them out thinking these will do another, they'll probably run up the road without me, you know. But I mean, I am that person. And then you might get an invitation from somebody like Jos Herman, who's Haile Gebrselassie's manager, or Mark Mild at the Berlin Marathon, you know, inviting you to come to their race, and they'll pay expenses and you'll be on the elite start. So you leave the sanctuary, you know, in your plimsolls with your vest into your knickers kind of runner, and you arrive to be greeted by some of the best runners in the world, staying in their hotel, at technical meetings, you know, working out, you know, sort of when, you know, they're going to make their big push for, you know, the final 10K of the Berlin Marathon. And you're just thinking, please let me finish, please let me finish. And, you know, the only pushing that's going to be going on at 30K for me is I'm likely to need pushing, you know. It's weird. And, so I just lead this kind of very, very bizarre kind of juxtaposed life of from amateur to uber professional. But when I have mixed with truly some of the top runners like Gebrselassie, I mean, he told me what he does for sports drink, for instance. So I was lucky enough on the Friday before the Amsterdam Marathon 1 year, you know, just saying that he makes his own little sports drink, you know, with one, you know, a bit of sugar, a bit of glucose rather, a bit of salt, some orange juice and some water. It's as good as anything else. And a lot of the top runners do work on stuff like, you know, it's going to be tough in a race. It's going to get, I suppose, I don't know, I'm not going to flatter myself because I really am not into that, but you've got to have a special sort of mindset to be able to push yourself through the real pain of any sort of race, but especially the endurance races, because it goes on for so long. And everybody goes to dark places in a marathon and has doubts, or an ultra marathon. For me, the motive is literally getting the best out of myself so I can be the best ambassador that I can for veganism. And hopefully somebody might see what I'm doing and think, you know, that person is vegan. You know, she's walking into the elite enclosure. She must be good. Perhaps I can try that. But if you don't train hard, you won't race hard. You can't expect yourself to race hard. You can't suddenly be, you know, stopping and starting for snacks and, you know, water and not going out if you feel that your toenail hurts, and then getting to a race and having the ability to say, look, I know I've broken my toes, because I did that one year just week before the marathon, the Sable, I fractured two toes. I know I've got two fractured toes, and I know this is supposed to be the world's toughest foot race or whatever it's supposed to be, but I want to do it for the animals. And to have that ability to go and push through that pain where your bone's sticking out your little toe or whatever, you've got to be used to training hard. And I do. I don't ever lie and say that it's 100% when I'm, whatever I'm doing it 100%, or I'm going to move on and do something else I think I could do better or is more productive for the cause that I'm out there and I believe in, which is encouraging people in a sympathetic way to consider veganism and to leave the animals and the planet alone, because actually it benefits directly them and other human inhabitants of this world. And, you know, I think, you know, leading by example and saying, you know, I'm not judging you, I'm just showing you what I've done, illustrating it through actions. And perhaps, you know, this could be for you.
And that passion that you have for the animals and for veganism and for making that change has kind of made you become an accidental celebrity in a way, hasn't it? But it's helping others make change as well. So it's working what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, people ask, a lot of people, if I am asked, what's your proudest achievement within running? Yeah. And I'm not, it's very, very kind of difficult thing to explain. I'm not particularly proud of anything I've ever done, because I'm not happy with the reason that's got me out there. I mean, I've literally only ever run to promote veganism. Yes, I want people to be vegan, but I don't want the exploitation, the cruelty, and the abhorrent misery and torture that goes on with animal, any sort of animal abuse or human abuse that is actually connected to it. So I'm not particularly proud to say of my physical running. I think the thing that I think has benefited most through the running is actually starting Vegan Runners back in 2004, and that was something that we did purely because of my running, really, because before that Peter Simpson and I were running, we're both in the Vegetarian Cycling and Athletics Club, which was the only club that bore any kind of resemblance of reason to why we were actually trying to run. And after I'd done my first marathon in London, and I'd kind of, you know, gone sub three, and I'd you know, come top 50, I think, or whatever, you know, we suddenly realized, actually, you know, you do realize that, you know, you're now going to be eligible to be on the start line with Paula Radcliffe, you know, if you choose any of these races. What are we doing promoting vegetarianism when actually we could be promoting veganism? There's a massive opportunity to get a large audience of people who are already invested in their diet, in their kind of looking to perform better, and if they think that they can get some advantage by whatever it is, they'll probably take it. Why don't we start a vegan running club? And that's what we did in 2004. So after the London Marathon, then I was able to go off to Florence and run, I think, a place fifth overall in the Florence Marathon, proudly wearing my vegan runner top. And I got a lot of attention for that at the race, purely because, you know, at the time, you couldn't go around and introduce yourself to like 20,000 runners and say, hello, I'm Fiona Oaks, I'm vegan. Hello, I'm Fiona. But, you know, by subliminally planting that word in people's minds. And, you know, I remember one year running up the Mall, and I came top 20 in the London Marathon this particular year. And I remember over the Tannoid, the male runners were bearing down quite quickly and the helicopters were overhead. And I remember them over the tannoy saying, and the next runner in is a vegan runner. I just remembered hearing as I ran up the mile alone the word vegan, and I thought, this is why I've done this. This is why I put myself through 5 months of horror training and the pressure to actually deliver in a marathon when you've got a specific goal in mind, you've got a time in mind, you really want to leave it all out there on the road. It's really, really hard. And, you know, I was listening to Eliud Kipchoge talking after Berlin last year, and he was saying, you know, whether I want to continue on running, it's something that I need to discuss with my family, because obviously he moved away from his family and went to a training camp, so that everyone was very like-minded, very focused, everyone was pushing each other. And it's a big commitment. It's a big denial, if you like, of your life. You know, to run 100 miles a week over 9 sessions every week, week in, week out for 4 months. Literally, I mean, when my niece was born, she was christened, and I didn't go because it was a Sunday and it was a long way away, and I couldn't take the time away from my training for one of these big races. It is kind of, you know, it's hard, and you know, never letting a session slip, and always, you know, knowing that you want to be improving, that you don't want to get injured. And then when you make it through the training period, then the taper period comes, and then you become like the world's biggest hypochondriac, in that you think you've got every, you know, that disease under the sun. You know, if somebody within 100 meters of you sneezes, you literally, don't come near me, don't come near me. I remember we were in a shop once that I was getting ready to go for a race, and somebody on the till behind, you know, I think in front of me, sneezed. And I remember dropping all the shopping and kind of backing away. Get out of the shop, get out of the shop. I don't want to get ill, because you can't run to your maximum. You can't run the time you want to if you've got a cold. You can't run at all if you've got a cold, you know, so you shouldn't do, you know. But so it is a big sacrifice, but it was always worth it, because I was doing it for the animals. And, you know, when you put sacrifice into terms, then you start saying, actually, compared to what the animals suffer, it's nothing. Yesterday, I've got my new little gadget, which is we've got a greenhouse, and I've got a treadmill in the greenhouse for training in hot weather. So yesterday, I went out and did my 2 hours, because I have to stay in case mum needs help with turning my dad, or if he's poorly, you know, and she has to clean him, I have to be around. But so I don't want to be out the sea wall, you know, a long way away. So I put this little treadmill into the greenhouse. So I do 2 hours on my treadmill. It was 115 degrees in there. And it was like, I thought, right, start steady, 12 kilometers an hour. Don't go any quicker than that, because you're going to be in trouble. And, you know, I was thinking when I was in there, it was hot. But, you know, in these chicken sheds and farrowing crates and horrible intense factory farms, what it must be like is absolutely incomprehensible. So when I thought, you know, like when you get on your treadmill and you've got like 2 hours to do, and after 5 minutes you're doubting.
Every time I get on a treadmill, yes.
And then you think, no, Fiona, actually, in 2 hours this will be over, and you can have a nice drink, and, you know, these animals never, ever escape that. So what are you moaning about? And that, honestly, the thought of their suffering is truly what drives me on. I don't particularly want to punish myself enough to just for a medal or a trophy or a Garmin or a time. And I don't want it that much. But I think if there's something that I can do to possibly, and it's no guarantees that the you know, the end of the race or the end of your life, that you've made any difference at all. But at least you've got the satisfaction of knowing that you tried.
And I think your honesty about, you know, why you do it and the way you do it resonates with so many people. And personally, you know, you've inspired me, and I know you've inspired hundreds, thousands and more of people to, you know, if not become vegan, maybe reconsider and start on that path. So I think from that perspective, you can say that you're certainly achieving what you set out to achieve.
I hope so.
We can't kind of end the interview, I don't think, without asking about Percy.
You
must tell, yeah, you must tell everyone about
literally.
Percy.
You can't. Trust me, you can't. No, little Percy. Right, okay. I like teddy bears. Yeah. I just like their cheery faces. They cheer me up. And Percy has been everywhere with me. It's just a little mascot of the side. No, I know, Percy, you're not a mascot. He's an integral part. I get it a little bit mixed up. Percy gets invited to the races and he lets me accompany him. You see what I mean? There's a difference there. I make my little Patreon videos and people have been saying, you've lost weight, Fiona, but Percy's gained some. And actually, they do know that actually Percy has a body double. He's such a megastar now that he doesn't do the training himself. He's got a little friend, little identical bear that's much fatter than him, Frank, and he goes out to all the training rooms in my pack and Percy comes on the adventures. There is a little bit of animosity between Frank and Percy over this, but Percy is, you know, he calls it seniority because he's older.
That's
so funny. It's just a little cheery bear that goes with me. And I don't know, to start with, I suppose that, you know, years and years and years ago, it was a little bit of an icebreaker because when I first went to Marathon des Sables in 2012, the setup was slightly different. So you literally just got put into a tent with seven other people, total strangers. Very often it was a very, very kind of male orientated world. So chances are that you're probably in with seven men. And I remember one year, the first year I did it, a guy called Brett was walking around the camp saying, you know, oh, you think your tent's bad. You want to try being in ours. We said, we've got a Scotsman, an Irishman, a Welshman, an Englishman, and we've got the vegan woman. Brett, you know, and so everybody used to make fun that, oh, it's the vegan woman with the little teddy bear, she can't be all that bad. And Percy just like, and Keegan actually said to me, I really like the concept of Percy. He's a really good, clever, kind of educational tool. I said, pardon? Just Percy, he's just my little friend and I carry him and he cheers me up and he cheers everybody else up. And he's actually amazing in some of the most difficult situations I've been in. People see a teddy bear and he kind of brings them together and they smile. And I think anything that can engender a smile on anyone's face in such a kind of dour world, and you know, it's got to be good. So Percy just travels with me and everybody loves him. It's not just kids. I mean, and in 2013, when I broke the world record at the North Pole doing the marathon there, a guy in Brazil started the PSGs, which is the Percy supporter group. And he took a picture of himself with all his teddy bears. And now people do send me bears to join the Percy supporter group. So the houses are full of bears everywhere. And at Percy's fan club. So, yeah, that's pretty much Percy. He is a member of Vegan Runners, but unfortunately he's so small that his top only says Eager Runners because the V and the N is missing on the back. But, you know, he's a little cheeky. He's probably my alter ego because Percy gets away with things that I can't get away with. But, yeah, he's been on all my running adventures with me and everybody knows Percy and they all love him. So he's got to be good.
Certainly puts a smile on everybody's faces, that's for sure. And I have to thank Percy for letting him, letting me speak to you today because obviously he was in correspondence with me. So, Fiona, it's been an absolute pleasure. I know you've got a 20-mile run to do now with no food or water. And a very busy day looking after all those wonderful animals.
Well, it's my favourite day at the sanctuary actually because feed delivery. So I get loads and loads of goodies brought in. By Friday, I have a big feed delivery every Friday. Always seems to be Friday. I think I'm living in Groundhog Day. Always Friday, always a feed merchant. But when loads of carrots and hard feed and I have ready grass and goodies come in, it always gives me that really, really warm feeling to see the feed store full up. And as the week dwindles, like Friday morning, it's getting desperate. You know, they're thinking, oh, no. But Friday afternoon, it's my favourite day because all the feed comes in. So I've got several tons of feed to unload when I get back from my run. But I do actually enjoy that kind of physical exercise because it's for the animals. But
And how can people support Tower Hill Stables Sanctuary?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I don't do social media a lot. I'm not very good, but obviously sharing stuff is always important because it widens the audience and people become, you know, more au fait with what you do. They can support an animal here. We had the Marathon de Cows running at the minute, where they can literally go through and see all the cows that are at the sanctuary, is well over 50, and pick, you know, read their stories and support them. You know, fundraise, you know, do a running event, you know, just support, share. I mean, you know, tell people, you know, whether it verbally or you know, or online about what we do. Sadly, a lot of it now is just about keeping going financially. Obviously, with the downturn in, you know, the economic situation globally, with cost price rises of everything, with the insecurities on, you know, we were always frightened of, you know, feed going up and not having enough money to meet the bills. It's unfortunately, it's all about that. But, you know, we battle on as much as we can. We will always do that for the animals. And we do have some wonderful supporters out there who, are, you know, really always do rally around and try to keep the sanctuary going. And, yeah, just share what the work we do. And more than that, consider, I don't know, everything, the sanctuary, everything is about encouraging people to at least consider veganism, not just for, you know, the benefits to themselves, but for the animals, the environment, for other human beings, for, you know, for their footprint that they're going to leave for future generations. And that's probably the biggest thing that I could ask people to do. Consider being plant-based and all the benefits it brings. And it's a win-win-win situation. Obviously, my primary thing is to keep the sanctuary going, but I'm passionate about also encouraging others to follow in the same path, you know, and to say that this lifestyle choice, it's beneficial, it's not prohibitive to anything. So if, you know, for people to consider not harming each other, not harming themselves, not harming the planet, not harming the animals, that's more what it's all about for me.
Well, you're doing a great job advocating that, Fiona, and we really appreciate it. And thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave a review for the Vegan Fitness Runner podcast. Please subscribe if you don't want to miss an episode. And remember, you can find out more about all my guests and further information on all the topics covered over on the website veganfitnessrunner.com. Thanks again, and bye for now.